The world and everything in it is made possible by listeners like us. Hi, I'm John Oster. I work as a chemist in Kansas City, Missouri, where I live with my wife and one-year-old son. My mother-in-law first introduced me to this podcast almost 4 years ago, and I've scarcely missed an episode since. I hope you enjoy today's program.
Good morning. President Biden wants Americans to drive electric cars, but how practical is that?
There's no way to sort of prove out an 8-year battery without actually waiting for 8 years. So we're trying to mimic in a 6-month test what will happen in 8 years.
Also today, you're paying more at the gas pump. We'll talk about why and what's being done about it. Plus, we'll meet a Georgia woman who helps families struggling to pay tuition at Christian school.
I always explain to them, this is manna from heaven. And we just keep taking it as long as it keeps falling.
And reflections of a mom on kids and fears of missing out.
It's Tuesday, September 21st. This is The World and Everything in It from listener-supported World Radio. I'm Mary Reichert.
And I'm Nick Eicher. Good morning.
Here now is Kent Covington with today's news.
Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas traveled to the Texas border city of Del Rio on Monday amid the ongoing border crisis, and he had a message for those who would enter the country illegally.
Irregular migration, the perilous journey, is not the journey to take. One risks one's life, the life of one's loved ones, for a mission that will not succeed.
Border Patrol agents are using horseback patrols to keep people from crossing the Rio Grande into Del Rio. Mayorkas said 600 Homeland Security employees, including from the Coast Guard, have been brought to the border city of about 35,000 people. The number of migrants at the Del Rio Bridge peaked at nearly 15,000 on Saturday. Officials have so far removed more than 6,000 Haitians and other migrants from an encampment along the border, and flights have begun taking Haitian migrants back to Haiti. Mayorkas called it a challenging and heartbreaking situation. The United States has announced a major easing of travel restrictions for foreigners flying into the country. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki told reporters,
"The older rules were not equitable in our view, and they were a bit confusing. And so this was an effort to pursue that."
Foreign travelers can begin flying into the United States this fall, provided they have proof of vaccination and a negative COVID-19 test. The changes, to take effect in November, will allow families and others who have been separated by travel restrictions for 18 months to plan for long-awaited reunifications. It will also allow foreigners with work permits to get back to their jobs in the U.S. The new policy will replace a patchwork of travel bans. Those rules restricted travel by non-citizens who have in the prior 14 days been in the UK, European Union, China, India, or several other countries. Biden will also tighten testing rules for unvaccinated American citizens who will need to be tested within a day of returning to the U.S. as well as after they arrive home. The head of the United Nations is imploring China and the United States to repair their, quote, completely dysfunctional relationship to head off a new Cold War.
And I think that we need to overcome this dysfunctionality. I think we need to avoid at all costs a Cold War that would be different from the past one.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres heard there, speaking ahead of this week's annual United Nations gathering of world leaders. He said a new Cold War would probably be more dangerous and more difficult to manage. Guterres said the world's two major economic powers should be cooperating on climate and negotiating more robustly on trade and technology. He acknowledged that several factors are complicating the relationship, including concerns about human rights, online security, and territory in the South China Sea. 2 years ago, Guterres warned of the risk of the world splitting in two, with the United States and China creating rival internets, currency, trade, financial rules, and, quote, their own zero-sum geopolitical and military strategies. Pfizer announced Monday that a low-dosage shot for children ages 5 to 11 provides strong protection against COVID-19. Senior Vice President Dr. Bill Gruber said Monday,
"We measured the ability of antibody from the children that were vaccinated to kill the virus and how well that matched up to antibody from 16 to 25-year-olds. And it matched very closely.
Pfizer plans to apply for emergency use authorization from the FDA by the end of the month. At the beginning of September, new pediatric infections accounted for roughly 29% of new weekly cases. Pfizer studied a dosage of one-third of the adult shot in more than 2,000 elementary-age children. The study is still ongoing, but initial results showed the same number of antibodies and similar or fewer temporary side effects. Moderna is also conducting a pediatric study. Both companies are testing the vaccine with children as young as 6 months old and expect to release results later this year. A student opened fire Monday at a university in Russia, killing at least six people and wounding dozens more. World's Anna Johansson Brown has that story.
Video footage showed a black-clad, helmeted figure striding on a campus sidewalk, cradling a long-barreled weapon. Moments later, the suspect walked inside and opened fire. During the attack, students and staff at Perm State University locked themselves in rooms, and Russian news sites showed footage of some students jumping out of second-story windows. The school is in the city of Perm, about 700 miles east of Moscow. The shooter reportedly had a permit for a pump-action shotgun, though it's not clear if that was the weapon used in the attack. Police shot and wounded the suspect before arresting him. Russian authorities are investigating the attack. Reporting for World, I'm Anna Johansson Brown.
And I'm Kent Covington. Straight ahead, the push for all electric vehicles, plus capitalizing on family time. This is The World and Everything in It.
It's Tuesday, the 21st of September, 2021. You're listening to World Radio, and we're so glad to have you along. Good morning. I'm Mary Reichard.
And I'm Nick Eicher. First up on The World and Everything in It, electric vehicles.
Here in my car, I feel safest of all. I can lock all my doors. It's the only way to live in cars.
Back in August, President Biden issued an executive order that could change the way we drive. By the year 2030, he expects half of all new cars sold in the United States to be electric. As of now, electric vehicles, or EVs as they're known, make up just 2% of U.S. car sales.
To push car companies in that direction, Biden's Environmental Protection Agency will require car companies to roll back emissions by 10% over the next year and a half, and then by 5% every year through the next 5 years. But that may not be the biggest challenge car makers face trying to meet the president's goal. World's Sarah Schweinsberg reports.
Tyler Wyman worked really hard during his college years for a pest control company. So when he turned 24, he bought himself his dream vehicle, a Tesla Model 3 all-wheel drive electric vehicle.
Yeah, that's something that I've always kind of been obsessed with. I've driven mostly hybrids, and so having an electric car was exciting to me.
He loved how fast the vehicle went, the technology inside, and he loved its fuel efficiency, or its lack of fuel. Now, Wyman is excited for other car companies to jump on the electric vehicle train. Audi, BMW, Buick, Cadillac, Chevy, Ford, GMC, Honda, Kia, Nissan, just to name a few, are all slated to release electric vehicle models in the next year or two.
Yeah, I think it's really exciting. A lot of a buzz that has been created lately is electric trucks. And so if there was an option where a truck did make sense and it wasn't going to cost an arm and a leg to fill up, that's something that would actually get me in a truck where traditionally I never would have considered it.
As countries crack down on emissions in order to combat climate change, car companies are betting on the future being electric. Investors are also jumping on board. Wall Street and Silicon Valley dumped $28 billion in electric vehicle companies last year. Bogdan Eperano directs the Automotive Research Center at the University of Michigan. He says pressure from the Biden administration will accelerate the move away from traditional internal combustion engines.
That will unlock the innovation strength of the United States, which is a very strong advantage.
But to keep up with President Biden's goals, the car industry will have to revolutionize what it's manufacturing and selling in just 8 years.
But there are also challenges in terms of the supply chain, challenges in terms of the technologies to be developed, and challenges in terms of the market acceptance.
The biggest challenge involves what makes these cars go. Today, most EVs use lithium-ion batteries.
I'm Venkat Vishwanathan, professor of mechanical engineering at Carnegie Mellon University. So I've been working on lithium-ion batteries for a little over a decade now.
This Wanathan says car companies will have to choose between battery trade-offs. So, for example, if a battery has a long range, its recharge time will probably be long. But if a battery charges quickly, that means it won't be able to go as far.
One of the main distinguishing factors for electric cars is going to be the battery, which will determine the sticker price, how long it'll go, and also how safe it'll be under operation.
And then car companies will have to decide what metals and minerals go into their batteries. Brett Smith is with the Center for Automotive Research. He says companies will need lithium, nickel, cobalt, and copper. But
right now, there is a very, very limited supply of those key materials in the U.S.
China, on the other hand, has some of the largest lithium reserves in the world.
And that is a supply chain problem. That's balance of trade problems. That is a lot of different worries as we move into this.
Then there's the question of safety. Lithium-ion batteries have the potential to explode or catch fire. Carnegie Mellon's Venkat Vishwanathan says in their rush to push out electric vehicle models, car companies will have to be really careful not to cut safety corners.
I think one of the challenges faced for many of the car makers that don't have years of fleet data to learn from. And so what they have to do is rely on sort of accelerated testing. So where you stress the battery under sort of extreme conditions and hope that that sort of mimics how they will age in a real world operation more slowly. So we're trying to mimic in a 6 month test what will happen in 8 years.
Besides engineering and battery questions, consumers also have to think about infrastructure concerns. The demand for charging all of these vehicles will put more strain on electrical grids, says Katie Tubb. She's an energy scholar at the Heritage Foundation.
That needs to be planned and prepared for amongst electricity generators and public utility commissions.
Tubb also points out that there will still be environmental trade-offs to using more electricity.
There's a lot of states that rely on natural gas and coal and nuclear for their electricity. That needs to be a consideration for you, that you have to consider not just that you're driving electric vehicle, but what is behind the plug.
Disposing of car batteries when the time comes also has downsides for the environment.
So in the case of batteries, recycling is very energy intensive. It yields a lot of byproducts, some of which are highly flammable, and it's not necessarily economic.
Tubb says when it comes to energy and vehicles, perfect solutions just don't exist. There will always be trade-offs. And she says American consumers should get to decide which trade-offs they're comfortable with, not the government through regulations. Tyler Wyman says after 2 years of owning a Tesla, he's concluded the trade-offs might mean switching vehicles. The biggest drawback is its range. He can only drive around 250 miles before his car needs a charge. And that isn't always practical.
As much as I like love the car and I definitely don't regret buying it, I definitely have recently thought about selling it and trying different options due to the fact of just like long distance driving and stuff like that. And so I'd say pros and cons.
Reporting for World, I'm Sarah Schweinsberg.
Up next, how energy policies in Washington affect your wallet. The average cost of a gallon of regular unleaded is now just north of $3 in the United States. That's up sharply from a year ago, though demand was down last year due to the pandemic. But it's also substantially higher than before the virus hit. On September 20th, 2019, regular unleaded was $2.66 per gallon.
Last month, National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan noted that, his words, the price of crude oil has been higher than it was at the end of 2019 before the onset of the pandemic. And he added that higher gasoline costs, if left unchecked, risk harming the ongoing global recovery. President Biden then pressed OPEC to ramp up oil production, but the United States is the number one oil producer in the world. So some are asking, is Washington doing anything to help ramp up oil supplies?
Well, you just heard from Katie Tubb at the Heritage Foundation a few minutes ago, and she joins us now with more insight. Katie, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks very much for having me on. Glad to have you. Well, first of all, we all know that there are a lot of factors that impact the price at the pump. So what caused the recent surge in gas prices?
Well, I think the immediate short answer is that, you know, there's far more involved in the price of gas than we can control, but there is a lot we can control. So the kind of the main component of gas prices comes from the price of crude oil. Crude oil is a globally traded commodity. So again, we have some control over that, but again, globally traded. So 55% of the price of gasoline comes from crude oil. The next major component is from refining that crude oil into gasoline that we can use. That's about 17% of the price of gasoline per gallon. And then about 16% is state, local, and federal taxes. And then the final component is the actual distribution and marketing of gasoline, which is about 13%. So there's a whole mixture of local, state, federal policies mixed in with just the global market for gasoline and crude oil products.
As we mentioned a minute ago, the White House has voiced concern about global oil prices and called on OPEC to do more. Now, OPEC's the cartel of 13 oil-producing countries. How is OPEC responding to market pressures?
Well, they have their own self-interest in this. You know, many of the OPEC nations draw a huge part of their revenue, their state revenue, from the oil industry. And I think that's a distinct difference between the United States, which is a privately run market, you know, a lot of many private companies versus state-owned entities. And so they have a very vested interest in global gasoline markets. And so they have no interest in accommodating the Biden administration. I think we've seen that historically over the decades. And so I think that's one reason why I found President Biden's remarks and Sullivan's remarks very just kind of tone deaf, that we have huge amounts of resources here in the United States, and yet they're coming to OPEC nations more or less begging for relief. And to me, that's an emphasis on the wrong syllable there.
Well, we know that President Biden has talked a whole lot about reducing our dependence on oil and gas in favor of electric cars, solar power, you know, things like that. How much of an impact have the current administration's policy had on oil production here in the United States?
Well, you know, you can see a lot by their actions. The administration has basically put a regulatory focus on every segment of the oil industry, whether we're talking about the exploration and production of resources, all the way through the supply chain to the actual use. And so it's been, I think, quite negative, even though some of these policies and regulations haven't been fully implemented yet. And just as an example of that, we're seeing reverberations through the economy with prices, whether we're talking about at the pump or with resources and goods and services that require energy, which is pretty much every aspect of the economy. An example of that is food prices. So I think what we're seeing is both a very overt, direct impact on the industry through things like the Keystone Pipeline or gasoline prices, but also another layer beneath that, where these industries, oil and gas industries in particular, and coal as well, I'll mention, are having a hard time finding investors and insurance because they're finding political resistance, and that risk factor is expanding as the administration becomes more and more robustly opposed to these industries. And I think that in the long term is very harmful for the economy and very harmful for just average Americans who need energy to have healthy and warm and, you know, productive lives.
Katie, does the president have a point, though, that we need to reduce our oil consumption and our overall emissions in order to take care of the environment?
You know, I think that is where we need to keep focusing the conversation, because, you know, regardless of what you think about global warming, and that is an issue, you know, I think we need to ask the next question of, okay, are the president's policies effective? And I would say robustly no. You know, we've modeled this out at the Heritage Foundation, that if you assume the UN's projections about warming over the next century as gospel, and then you model the effects of, say, reducing emissions in the United States by 50 to 52%, which is what the Biden administration is shooting for, you get a moderating of temperatures, global temperatures, of 0.4 degrees Celsius by the end of the century. So again, you know, regardless of what you think about climate as an issue, it's very evident to me that the president's policies are not effective. So they're very expensive for basically no impact on global temperatures by the end of the century. And to me, that is a failed climate policy.
Katie Tubb with the Heritage Foundation has been our guest. Katie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Additional support comes from mission-focused Men for Christ Sunday Night Podcast, helping dads winsomely guide their kids into a biblical worldview. Mission-focused Men for Christ on your podcast app. From whatwillthelearn.com, a free college search tool focused on what matters most, learning in the classroom. Only 24 colleges earn an A. More at whatwillthelearn.com. And from Covenant College, a distinctly Christian liberal arts college on beautiful Lookout Mountain, Georgia. More at covenant.edu.
Taxi fleets in Thailand are giving new meaning to the term rooftop garden. Some parking lots are loaded with taxi cabs, still not in service due to COVID. But workers from two taxi cooperatives have decided to put the cars to good use, even while they are otherwise not in use. They have assembled miniature car top gardens. They stretched black plastic bags across bamboo frames, then added soil on top of that and began growing produce on the roofs and hoods of the cars. We're talking tomatoes, cucumbers, and string beans. One taxi operator explained the car top vegetable garden is both an act of protest against virus lockdowns and a way to feed my staff during this tough time. It's the world and everything in it. Today is Tuesday, September 21st. Thank you for turning to World Radio to help start your day. Good morning. I'm Nick Eicher.
And I'm Mary Reichard. Coming next on The World and Everything in It, learning to serve. It's more than a catchphrase. World senior correspondent Myrna Brown introduces us to a wife and mother who's made it her mission to plant seeds of service.
Mandy Hudson has helped hundreds of students get into private schools across Georgia.
I always explain to them this is manna from heaven, and we just keep taking it as long as it keeps falling.
In 2008, the state of Georgia joined 20 other states across the country and created a tax credit scholarship. The scholarship is funded by businesses and corporations.
Members of S corporations or LLCs or partnerships, they can do up to $10,000 a year. And then C corporations in the state of Georgia can give up to 75% of their tax liability. And that's
Hudson says even ordinary folks can choose to donate to nonprofit organizations called SSOs or student scholarship organizations.
So a married couple filing a joint income tax return in Georgia could give up to $2,500 to their chosen SSO.
In 2009, Hudson created her own SSO, Learning to Serve. It's eligible to receive and distribute millions of tax credit dollars to students currently attending K through 12 public schools.
The state of Georgia, in the beginning, they had about $50 million in the tax credit opportunity bucket for us. The last 2 years, we've seen it increase up to $150 million in Georgia.
Since starting her SSO, the wife and mother of three has awarded at least $4 million in private school scholarship money to students like Michael Rogers.
It baffled me when I was little that people, my friends, couldn't pray at school. I mean, I prayed, we prayed in the mornings before classes, prayed before lunch. I thought it was strange that no one else could do that in public school.
But when Rogers was in first grade, his family began having financial troubles.
And I know sometime when I was a kid, my dad was forced to sell our automobile glass company. And there was a little bit of a bumpy road there where we needed a little bit of help paying for school. And I know that's when Miss Mandy, she came in to help us.
17-year-old Rogers is now a high school senior, finishing his last year at Kings Ridge Christian School in North Fulton County, Georgia. Najma Hill lives 60 miles east in DeKalb County, Georgia. Hill is a single mom of three. Her youngest, Bryce, has learning disabilities and was ready to drop out of school.
Because my son was ready, and he was just in elementary school at this point, had not transitioned to middle school. And he's like, I hate school. I don't want to go. So I just had to figure out, you know, what was going to work best for him to succeed. You know,
Hill believed a private Christian school education would be key to Bryce's success. She had a school in mind, but on a hospital insurance specialist salary, she couldn't afford it.
At the time, probably made 30-some-odd thousand a year.
Once Hill found Learning to Serve, Bryce started receiving scholarships and transitioned into his new school environment. Hill says the changes were immediate.
I feel like, you know, he learned more about God. He understood the Bible. He would come home and, you know, talk about what was in the Bible. And, you know, he would kind of associate it or, you know, make it to where he understood it to apply in his daily life.
Out of the 28 SSOs in Georgia, Hudson says hers is the only organization that requires students to earn their scholarships by giving back. It's a lesson she learned 30 years ago.
It was my senior year of high school, and I had an opportunity to go on a government studies trip to D.C. through the
Clemson. Hudson says her family couldn't afford to pay for the Washington, D.C. field trip. That's when a neighbor stepped in.
And he certainly could have funded it right then and there, but he said, I would like to help you, but I would like for you to do something for your community in order for me to help you. And so he rewarded me for my hours of service for the Kiwanis Club selling Christmas trees and for wherever I could find volunteer time. And it just stuck with me for the rest of my life that
she's been planting seeds of service ever since.
So we have, you know, first and second graders that are volunteering to go and sit or sing at nursing homes. And, you know, we have some that mow lawns in their neighborhood or in their, you know, their towns. We have, you know, mission trips all over the world that children are participating in. We have some that volunteer on farms. We have
students like Michael Rogers.
No, Scout, it's not time to eat. You have been eating literally all morning.
Every Tuesday after school, Rogers volunteers at Save the Horses, a 22-acre horse rescue farm in his community. He's been feeding, brushing, and taking long walks with Scout since second grade.
This experience will always be the spot in my life where I began to love to help people. It started my career in service.
Najma Hill says her son Bryce has learned to serve at their church.
He started helping with, you know, cleaning the sanctuary, the bathrooms, and helped with the landscaping. It was the best decision I could have made for him.
Mandy Hudson says she's working to make sure more parents have the opportunity to choose the school that will allow their children to become the best they can be in both in and out of the classroom.
We only have them for a short period of time during the day. They spend two-thirds of their life with the people they're at school with. And so you want to make sure those people are, you know, investing in your children the way that you would if you had them at home with you.
Reporting for World, I'm Myrna Brown in Eatonton, Georgia.
Well, now take down your fishing pole and meet me at the fishing hole. We may not get a bite all day, but don't you rush away.
Today is Tuesday, September 21st. Good morning. This is The World and Everything in It from listener-supported World Radio.
I'm Mary Reichard.
And I'm Nick Eicher. You know, you can learn a lot down at the Fishing Hole, including lessons of faith, as world commentator Whitney Williams says.
I can't think of a better way to pass the time of day.
To be or not to be in sports? That is the question that often plagues this minivan-driving mama. Whether 'tis nobler for our family of five to commune together at the dinner table each evening, or to suffer the slings and arrows of full calendar chaos. Okay, I'm no Shakespeare, but seriously, my eldest turned 8 in August, and he's yet to be on a sports team. It seems we're the only ones not in something. Of course I'd allow him to if he asked, but he hasn't. Should I sign him up for a team or some sort of lesson? I wonder as I watch his friends rushing off to practice. Is he missing out? Girl, before that kid could say goo goo gaga, y'all had his footed pajama self loaded up in a fishing boat. My inner Northeast Texan reminds me. He ain't missing out. I remember that first trip well. We even brought his Exer saucer on the boat. And he's been fishing ever since, thanks to a dad/coach who is passionate about the sport and loves sharing it with his family.
Good throw, man.
Come wind, rain, and sleet, come 103-degree heat, Coach Williams often has his team out the door and heading to the lake by 3:30 a.m. Lessons include how to throw a cast net, baiting one's own hook, identifying different species of fish, and talking the talk. Doing any good? My kids have learned to inquire of nearby fishermen. All three have mastered the spinning reel. No push buttons on this boat. And our eldest displays several tournament-winning trophies on his dresser. He actually felt slightly embarrassed by how well he did at the most recent kid fishing tournament. Most fish, biggest fish, most catfish, most bass, most unusual catch, a yellow bullhead. Perhaps we'll throttle back a little next year, Coach Williams said, smiling as he patted his son on the back.
I almost went under the dock. He pulled me.
That fish pulled you, you mean?
Barely.
You want another worm?
I kind of perched, Gigi, by the dock.
My favorite part of that day was sitting on the bank in the shade, watching my firstborn kayak around the small lake all on his own with his rod and reel. He suddenly looked so grown up to me, casting his line patiently toward down trees and decrepit docks, dealing with his own hooks, hang-ups, and deep thoughts. Pride and anticipation swelled in me and Coach Williams as we saw him quickly pull up on his rod to set the hook and start reeling. A nice-sized bass jumped dramatically into the air near my son's kayak as he continued to reel wide-eyed and vigorously. I could see his smile from across the lake and could sense his excitement and pride as he got the fish into the boat and began paddling back to us. Things were different now, I thought as I watched him. Fishing was no longer just a passion of his daddy's for which he tagged along. It was personal now. And may it be the same with his faith, Lord, I prayed as I rejoiced with my son, wrote down his fish's measurements, and took at least 10 photos of him not missing out. I'm Whitney Williams.
Hey, ready? See ya.
Tomorrow, raising taxes. The Democrats have big plans to help pay for their big spending. We'll talk about who is going to foot the bill. And we'll catch up with some Afghan immigrants who are settling into their new lives in California. That and more tomorrow. I'm Nick Eicher.
And I'm Mary Reichard. The world and everything in it comes to you from World Radio. World's mission is biblically objective journalism that informs, educates, and inspires. A reminder for those living in the Twin Cities area, Minneapolis, St. Paul, The World and Everything in It Live. We'll be recording the program live on September 30th, and we would love for you to be there. We'll place a link in today's program transcript so you can sign up, or from our podcast page. Click on Live Events, and you'll find it there. The Bible says the Lord sees not as man sees. Man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart. Go now in grace and peace.